From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. One of the great things about art is the way it allows us to see the world through the eyes of other people. So it stands to reason that if we want to learn more about the life experiences of people with disabilities, we can do so by finding out more about the art that people with disabilities create. On today's program, Disability in the Arts. Take John Callahan. He's quadriplegic and a cartoonist, and he's worried.
I'm afraid the general public is going to turn against disabled people and drive them out of the country. They're getting too much of a presence.
John Callahan is best known for his outrageous single-panel cartoons. But he's exploring other media, like television. He's got a new animated TV series on Nickelodeon called Pelswick. John Callahan told Steve Paulson why he created the show.
Well, I had been drawing cartoons, you know, single-panel cartoons for many years. And, you know, under the name of Callahan, my regular strip name, and the kids come up and ask me constantly, you know, about the experience of being in a wheelchair. And finally, I had, you know, just so many little questions, like, you know, is your girlfriend paralyzed too? Or do you sleep in the wheelchair? Do you feel it if a shark bites your legs or something? And I decided to just create a character that sort of took away the mystery.
So you wanted to do something realistic?
Yeah, I want to do something. It's realistic, but it's very out there cartoon-wise also.
Now you have another animated TV series, don't you? Quads?
Yeah, Quads. It was originally called When Quads Won't Leave, and Dan Aykroyd told me I should shorten it to Quads, so, which I think was a good move. But it is in Canada. It's playing in Canada now. We're hoping to get it into America soon.
What's that series about?
It's a little bit more adult-oriented. It has to do with characters that I've used in my cartoons over the years that are disabled and messed up in different ways. One of them is one of the characters has got hooks for hands. Another one is paralyzed. Another one is it's like a disembodied head on a skateboard. Another one is a guy that claims to be blind and black but not musical. And so there's several of them. They all live together. They were run over by a rich fellow in Beverly Hills and paralyzed and messed up, and he, out of guilt, bought them a mansion next door to himself in a wealthy town, and the rest of it is like, you know, they're leeching-offing and bugging him.
Now, some of these characters I recognize from old cartoons you've done, like the guy who was blind and black but not musical. Didn't you get a lot of hate mail when that cartoon came out?
I think I got a certain amount, but, you know, most people that I know that were black complimented me on the cartoon. They thought it was funny. It's in tradition of the Stevie Wonder and Blind Lemon Jefferson.
Wasn't the cartoon a blind black beggar is holding out a cup and he has this sign saying, "Please help me, I am blind and black, but not musical."
Yeah, that was a joke, yeah.
Do you feel like you're pushing the line there at times?
Well, I don't really feel like it. I feel like in a lot of ways I feel like a fairly good-hearted person, but I was just born without that little editor in your brain, you know? I leave it up to newspapers to edit me, but it's real tough to constrict yourself, get too involved with political correctness. I don't think it's good to set about just to insult people, but it's okay to just be funny, and if you can take the responsibility, if you can take the heat, you know, I got thick skin, I guess.
Do you have editors who sometimes pull your cartoons because they consider them offensive?
Well, mostly over the years, they don't seem to pull my cartoons. I mean, I've had some horror stories over the years in the larger daily papers around the world where people have pulled me, but it's been fairly seldom.
Give me one or two examples of that, of cartoons that were considered beyond the pale.
I think once in the Miami Herald, which I was in the Sunday Miami Herald for many years, they hired me to be outrageous for the paper and to sort of do outrageous cartoons, but I did one on Martin Luther King, who's one of my heroes, but they claim they accidentally let it get by the editor, and they published tens of thousands of newspapers, and then they had to stop the press, round up all the papers that were on the street, and then, you know, edit the cartoon out and reprint another one and start the press again and reissue the paper.
What was in that cartoon?
Martin Luther King at the age of 13 is he's talking to his mother. And he's sort of indicating to the bed sheet, which is stained. He's saying, "I had a dream."
I can see why that wouldn't go over in some circles.
But I went on to the radio shows in Miami and talked about it. I've had good feedback on it eventually.
Now, you're also not shy about poking fun at people with disabilities. Do you take a particular delight in that?
Well, not really. It's just, I think, and I just hate to use the M word, metaphor, but it seems like kind of a metaphoric for life, the disability thing. It's like, to me, and I hate it when people say, oh, everybody's got their own disability. Everybody's disabled in one way or another. But, you know, and it's true. So, I mean, you know, people recognize themselves in these cartoons, whether it's about a guy that's blind or paralyzed or someone who's anorexic or, you know, the subject of divorce or death.
But I get the feeling that you get kind of ticked off at all the talk about victimization because someone, I don't know, has lost the use of his legs, that therefore he is a victim.
You know, my website is popular because so many people love the car, angry. I have hundreds of angry letters that have come to me over the years. And, you know, everything from Sally Struthers' agent to different people who have expressed, but it's invariably people that do not, you know, have the disability or have the dilemma, that write these protective cartoons saying, you know, we need to be really sensitive. And it's, you're going to sensitive people right to death in this country, you know.
How do you feel about the portrayals of people with disabilities in movies and on TV?
Well, I think they're getting better. I mean, they're being more accurate now. You see people on the front of the Wheaties box or something, and disabilities of people. That's almost obnoxious. There's disabled people climbing mountains in wheelchairs and iron lungs and blind people sailing and, you know, and everything has got to be accessible. And it's almost, I'm afraid the general public is going to turn against disabled people and drive them out of the country. They're getting too much of a presence.
Keep them down. Put them under wraps.
It's time to re-oppress them.
Well, I have to ask about the movie that I understand is being made out of your autobiography. Don't Worry, mm-hmm. He Won't Get Far on Foot. Robin Williams is going to be starring in it. Is that right?
Yeah, Robin Williams is going to play me. And it's going to be directed by Gus Van Sant. And the screenplay is written by Patty Sullivan. And so it's moving along. You know, I just don't know. You know, they always say, well, when we get a window of opportunity. But I go down to San Francisco and go to California and visit the people and visit Robin and become friends with him. And
I know there's some controversy about able-bodied actors portraying disabled people. And I'm curious if you see that as a problem. Obviously, Robin Williams is not disabled.
Well, I wouldn't want to see him go out and purposely break his back just to play the part correctly, but I'm not that squidgy about having people, you know, who are not disabled play the part. You know, I mean, God forbid that they should have the reverse of it, but I just hope people don't start rumors that my little cartoon character, Pelswick, on Nickelodeon isn't really, you know, disabled.
Do you see that as a problem, though, and in other media portrayals, that it tends to be able-bodied people who play people with disabilities?
Well, I think it's changing, and I think it's healthy. It gets so rigid that political correctness enters in there, where you have to be a Jew to play a Jew, or you have to be an Irishman to play an Irishman. Come on, you know, people can play different parts. It's called acting, you know?
Now, you did a cartooning guide called How to Relate to Handicapped People. Can you tell me about that and what motivated you to create that?
Well, I was just challenged by the editor one day, one of the editors of a newspaper, to come up with that because people are so afraid of a wheelchair. I don't think they are now. I mean, people are more used to, and I don't know. I think it's just because of the virtue of the publishing of that guide that I drew. But it's just the people. You see more and more disabled presence, and in fact, 20 years ago when I was paralyzed in California in L.A., people would take the walk a long way around you and avert their eyes and walk on eggshells around you. Now people are very at home. I mean, they don't look twice at you. And I was waiting in line at a movie the other day. The kids are sitting on my wheels of my chair, lounging around on me. It's like, you know, oh, God, not another quad, you know? Things have changed.
Really? These kids you didn't even know and they were just sitting on your wheelchair?
Yeah. You know, it's almost like, you know, too familiar. You know, I had to go back to the old Elephant Man days, you know? There's a certain mystique you have when you're, you know, considered a horrible pariah. I kind of miss the days.
You might be able to get some extra mileage out of that.
I still refer to myself as an invalid.
But that's an interesting question, whether it would be okay to do these cartoons if you're not paralyzed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think let the artist beware. I mean, whatever you... It seems like if you can... I have no idea how that works. Why a person can get away with it when they're disabled? I mean, it seems like anybody should be able to draw anything about disabled people, or any other subject. But it just doesn't work that way. You've got apparently have to have the experience.
So that wouldn't offend you if you came across someone else who did that kind of cartoon and had no personal experience?
I don't think it would offend me. I don't see how it would. I mean, it seems like fair game. If the person, it wouldn't personally offend me. I can see how it would offend other people, but. I mean, what happens someday if I reveal the fact that I'm not really paralyzed and I've just done it as a gag to get away with murder as a cartoonist? I mean, that would be funny, wouldn't it? I mean, if I come out in a year and say, I've never been paralyzed, I'm just doing it for a gig to have leverage as a cartoonist. I mean, maybe I will do that. Maybe I'm not really paralyzed.
Oh, okay. Well, keep us on our toes. Do you?
Only my acupuncturist knows for sure.
Are you trying to provoke outrage with your work?
No, I don't really. But, you know, there are some people or some groups that are a little bit more humorless and fun to pop the bubble on than other groups. And, you know, they're just a little bit, you know, whether it's what you're talking about, the far right or the far left. But some of these victim-y groups are just so fun to lower the bomb on. I mean, you just can't resist once in a while. I allow myself the option once a year to draw. But usually I draw just what's funny. But also, funny to me is politically incorrect.
John Callahan is a cartoonist whose autobiography is called Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot. He talked with Steve Paulson. That's pianist John Davis from his CD John Davis Plays Blind Tom. Blind Tom was the stage name of Thomas Green Wiggins, a blind black pianist born into slavery in 1849. Colonel James Neal Bethune, a respected lawyer and newspaper editor in Columbus, Georgia, bought Blind Tom and his family and ran their lives. Geneva Handy Southall is the author of Blind Tom, the black pianist composer continually enslaved. She told me how Blind Tom's remarkable musical career began.
The sounds interested him. All kind of sounds. Storms, rain, the water dripping, the churning, everything. And so when he heard the piano playing, he began to search until he found himself at the piano. And what happened is one day they had a program, and that night they heard this piano going, and they just assumed it was one of the girls playing. And they went down and found out it was Tom. He was playing what he had heard.
How old was he then?
He was about 4.
So a natural talent in some ways, at least.
Yeah, so what happened is when they discovered that, then they began to teach him. It was kind of like seeing what he could learn, and it was a fun thing for the children. And so by the time he was 5 or 6, he had been, you know, taught by one of the daughters. And then they realized he was of interest in the neighborhood, as you call it. And so Bethune would take him into his office. He got a piano and put in his law office. And Columbus, Georgia at that time was a very big cultural center. The showboats would come, and they'd be bringing in all the top artists in the country at that time. And so every time a pianist or someone of note came in, they would bring that person in to teach Tom. to give him lessons. So they were building up his repertoire. They also took him to all the plays and the operas that came. So he was hearing the operas, and therefore he was improvising. Later on, he's going to be improvising on the operatic themes, which was very common for that day.
Doesn't this strike you as at all odd that they would do all of this for a small black boy?
No, because they were going to make money off of him. So I guess it's not odd.
Yeah.
You know, you had a lot of slave musicians in that day who were being used to make money for their slave owners.
So they began to put him on stage.
Then. Yeah, in 1857, they took him, gave his first professional concert at Columbus Temperance Hall.
Was he playing classical music?
Oh, yes. That's all he ever played, because that's what he heard.
What was there anything else in his act?
Oh, yeah. They had the big thrill was the so-called challenge part of his program. They had a thing where they'd bring up musicians from the audience to come up and play pieces for Tom, and he'd hear them. And they were pieces that had never been published. So they were usually by some composer, pianist, and they'd play this piece for Tom, and Tom would play it back. Almost exact.
Wow.
And that was the one of the drawing cards. And he, from what all the reviews would say, he kept this up, and they would never be able to stump him. In fact, even if they'd play a wrong note, they'd do it purposely. Tom would hit the wrong note. He'd play what he heard.
Now, did he do anything other than play the piano as
yes,
part of his act?
Yes, he played flute and I think trumpet. But the main thing he also did, he would recite the speeches of people he would hear, such as the Stephen Douglas orations, the political orations. He was playing those. I mean, he'd speak those behind.
So he was able to reproduce those
yeah,
in the same way that he reproduced
reproduce
the piano.
What he heard. That was the idea.
Yeah.
And of course, then he was kind of removed from his maternal biological family and brought in as part of the Bethune household. And his life was the piano. Hmm. And he was like the little pet, you know, for the kids. And they would take him around, show him off. And pretty soon they began to travel with him.
Now, he was always known as Blind Tom. Did he have any other disabilities in addition to being blind?
Well, the one they just played up, of course. But you mean physical?
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think so. It's just the eyesight.
Because one of the things that when you first came across him, you heard him described at was an imbecile. Which...
And that continued in a lot of the reviews.
Now, why did they call him that?
You know, they just said he was an imbecile. Well, which wasn't odd for black folks to be called imbeciles, you know.
He was even promoted, wasn't he?
Yes. See, that was part of the promotion. And I said that one of the reasons they kept saying he'd never been taught, and he was taught all his life, and had some of the top teachers. And when I found the law cases, the piano teacher in New York said he'd been with him for 9 years. But what happened was by promoting him by having never been taught, it was easier to promote him as an imbecile. Hmm. That was more money getting him that way because you left a mystery. It was the mystery part that brought in all the people.
One of the other things that was written about him, I gather, was that he would make sounds in imitation of instruments.
Of anything he heard. Animals, the railroad, the trains, and water, and after all, he did have to use his hearing to make up for his sight problem.
And he composed music as well.
Oh, yes. That's what I'm saying. The piece that I saw, the Rev Charmain, he wrote that. I mean, they published his pieces, and he was he wrote a lot of piano pieces. Some things we'll never have because a lot of things were improvised, and those things were not written down.
Mm-hmm. Did he earn a lot of money doing this?
Oh, my God, yes. They wouldn't have fought over him like they did if it hadn't been he was making money. What use would they have for a blind person, you know, who would need all this help? No, he made fortunes for the owners. You have to remember, James Bethune was a well knowledgeable political figure and a lawyer. Mm-hmm. So what he did is he had Charity and Mingo to sign an indenture for him to have Tom for 5 years.
That's Tom's mom?
Yeah, Tom's mom and father. Well, of course, as the father said later, he said, I didn't know what I was signing. Yeah. They couldn't read. So they signed with an X, of course. And it was the Freedmen's Bureau signed it on. So what happened, he had this giving him Tom for 5 years. Now, you have to remember that a lot of the slaves had been given a lot of false information about the North. And as a result, the mother and father probably had been scared about what would happen to Tom. And he had lived all his life with the Bethunes, and he was now 16. And so the mother and father might have, you know, you don't know what was going through their mind, but they were able to trick them. And so what happened when he got this indenture paper is interesting. A black man who was a showman had heard about Tom, and he had gotten Bethune, before the war was over, to sell Tom to him for the show. And he was going to take him north, take his family, and he was going to present him.
So he put him on stage and took him
out? No, what happened is, after the war, the Bethunes retracted on that. And you got to remember, we'd had the Dred Scott, so that meant anything the black man said wasn't going to mean anything anyhow. And so when Bethune brought Tom on his concert tours after the Civil War, he took him north for the first time. And when he got to New Albany, Indiana, he is hit with those papers that he had illegally kept Tom, and that Tom belonged to Tabs Gross, who was the black man, and he had papers and everything. So the court was going to give Tom to this man, and the next thing you know, Bethune had left town. And when he got to Cincinnati, Tabs Gross again hits him with the papers, and it ends up in a court case. And of course, based on those indenture papers, the judge is going to give Tom to James Bethune, saying that's what his mother and father wanted. So that's how he got him to start with. And that was the first of many.
After the war, did Tom continue to perform?
Oh, yes. He performed up until 1904.
And all over the country?
All over the country and in Europe.
But he still belonged in one form or another to the Bethune
up until
family.
1887.
Yeah.
And that was a big court case there, because what happened, his son, who was now the kind of managing Tom, had died in a train, trying to get on a train, off a train, or whatever that was. And he died in Wilmington, Delaware. And he had been married to a Miss Eliza Stutzbook, who became Mrs. Eliza Bethune. There had been some decision that he was going to divorce her. And then when he died, he left her out of the will. And that's something you don't do to women. She was a woman scorned, and she was not going to take that. So what she did is she was able to find Tom's mother and bring her to New York and had her to file for her son. She used the mother, and that thing was a big court case.
And so she eventually got...
And she got him. Because, see, what happened after the 5 years was up, Bethune went and had himself made guardian. Being a lawyer, he knew all the tricks of the trade. So Tom's life is always surrounded by legal people.
Geneva Handy Southall is the author of Blind Tom, the Black Pianist Composer Continually Enslaved. She's also Professor Emeritus of Afro-American Studies at the University of Minnesota. This is Dr. Southall's favorite Blind Tom composition, Rêve Charmant Nocturne, performed by John Davis. Coming up, we'll look at the cinema of isolation, how filmmakers have portrayed people with physical disabilities over the years. And we'll explore life with cerebral palsy, courtesy of playwright and performer Lyle Victor Albert. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Lyle Victor Albert has performed his one-man show, Scraping the Surface, more than 700 times, in his home country of Canada, here in the U.S., and in the United Kingdom. Scraping the Surface chronicles his experiences with cerebral palsy. Before the show, Lyle Victor Albert was just a playwright, but he told Steve Paulson that becoming a performer was a pleasant experience.
I quite enjoyed it. I felt quite comfortable on stage, and I didn't do it before because I thought because I have cerebral palsy, it's not really in the cards for me. But, hey, it worked out.
How would you describe Scraping the Surface?
First and foremost, it's a comedy. It's a comic monologue about me growing up in different stories that happened to me or things that I've embellished. I hate the term, but for lack of a better one, sort of a coming-of-age sort of fable, as it were. So, yeah, that's how I would describe it.
Now, you had not written explicitly about cerebral palsy before this, had you?
No. When I started out my career, I made a conscious choice not to, because I didn't want to be labeled, you know, a disabled playwright, or he writes about disabled issues. I just didn't want that label. So I thought, nah, I'm not gonna go there. So I wrote about all different kinds of stuff. And when I started doing this monologue, it was only supposed to be 50 minutes done one time, so I thought, hey, you know, no big deal. But much to my surprise, I think I struck a chord with the audience and also myself.
I'm wondering if you could give us a taste of Scraping the Surface, if there's a piece of the monologue that you could perform.
There's a piece here. I'll just set it up a bit. It's about getting a birthday present on my 17th birthday. My parents must have sensed this because on the day of my birthday, I was presented with a box, all neatly wrapped with ribbons and bows, with a card that read, "We know you can really use this now." It's an innocent enough statement, but whenever I read it, little bells went off in my head. It meant I was getting something good for me, which is great. Everybody needs something that's good for them. But let me ask you this. When you're 8 years old and jumpy, and your sister gives you an Erector set for Christmas, is that really good for you? I mean, you got tiny nuts and tiny bolts, and the idea is to attach the tiny nut to the tiny bolt. Then you take a little screwdriver and a little wrench, and you try to tighten the tiny nut to the tiny bolt. And once you've done this 10,204 times, you have something big, which now you have to take apart because it's time to go to bed. Or in my case, it was time to go to university. The theory behind the Erector Set is that it would teach patience, concentration, and coordination. And God knows those are three things I really can use. But when my other sister gave me the operation game, you lose, I began to suspect that maybe my family had a different agenda. Oh, sure, they loved me. But in the days before cable, I was the best entertainment around.
And how old did you say you were when you had gotten the present?
8 years old.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Are you pretty open with, I assume you are, with your family, with your parents about cerebral palsy?
Oh,
I mean, something you, I mean, you talk a lot about. And
it's not like I can hide it. No, you know, growing up, it was great because I grew up on a farm and, you know, although I didn't operate the heavy machinery, you know, I had chores like everybody else and I got treated like everybody else, so.
I'm wondering if we could end with another piece of your performance.
Petrocella Krasinowski was a girl with her whole life planned out until something better came up. She was a political science major working towards a PhD in international relations, which she would parlay into a job at the United Nations and over the course of time become a diplomat in some exotic locale. Well, she would inevitably meet and fall in love with an aristocrat and make many baby aristocrats. But right now, she was in a first-year philosophy course with me. Understanding 202. Since we shared the last class of the day, Petrocella and I and other like-minded individuals would retire to the nearest coffee shop and discuss why the prof didn't know what the hell he was talking about. And we did, being first-year philosophy students. These little tete-a-tetes went on all semester until one night, after a particularly lively discussion on why the Soviet Union would never abandon communism, Petrocella and I found ourselves alone, together. Seeing that we both had term papers due the next day, we decided to have another cup of coffee. It was then that Petrocella put her hand on mine and said, "I understand." Not knowing what she meant, I said, "Hey, that's great. You'll probably get a good mark then." Back in her apartment, with absolutely no thoughts of looming term papers, Petrocella and I were on the couch. We kissed, and she handed me this, a condom. As I held it in my hand, I was filled with complete and utter dread. I've had a lot of experience with things like this. The curse of the vacuum wrap. All my life I've been tormented by these little wonders of packaging. Creamers and ketchup pouches and little containers of strawberry jam, all designed to take forever to open. And when you do, the contents are guaranteed to go everywhere except where you wanted them to. But hey, I've adapted. I drink my coffee black. I eat fries with just a touch of salt. But in this situation, I had to get the jam on the toast.
That's wonderful.
Lyle Victor Albert is the author and the one and only cast member of Scraping the Surface. He talked with Steve Paulson.
We got the gimp. Gimp sleep. Well, I guess you just have to go wake him up now, won't you?
Boys, don't never, but never make fun of no cripples.
You wouldn't be able to do these awful things to me if I weren't still in this chair. But you are, Blanche. You are in that chair.
Coming soon to a radio near you, off to the movies to find out how Hollywood has portrayed people with physical disabilities over the years. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. What do the following films have in common? The Elephant Man, Of Human Bondage, Mask, and Scent of a Woman. You got it. They all feature characters with physical disabilities, and those are just a few titles from a very long list. Martin Norden is the author of The Cinema of Isolation, A History of Physical Disability in the Movies. He told Anne Strainchamps that people with physical disabilities have been in the movies from the beginning.
When the movies began in the late 1890s, up until about the World War II era, we're talking roughly a 40-year period, there were a number of stereotypes that began emerging about disabled people, and they tended to follow fairly rigid gender and age-related parameters, I guess you would call them. In the case of men, adult males who were disabled, they tended to fall into a stereotype that I call the obsessive avenger. And typically it's a recently disabled male who becomes exceptionally embittered and relentlessly seeks revenge on the person, or in the case of Captain Ahab, the entity responsible for his disablement or some other moral code violation. And usually that character is dead by the end of the film. That's one extreme stereotype.
Are those characters usually the villains, or are they sometimes people we're sympathetic towards?
Yeah, almost always villains. Characters like Captain Hook, for example, who there was actually a silent era film version of Peter Pan that came out, I think, in 1928, and it had this very obsessive kind of character who just relentlessly seeks revenge on Peter Pan and so on. What's interesting, though, is that in the case of women and children, they were portrayed in a very different way if they had disabilities. It's the opposite end of the stereotype spectrum, what I call the sweet innocent. It's the character who is perfect in every way, except for the disability. I mean, the person might be sweet and pure and godly and virginal and exceptionally pitiable, and like the Tiny Tim kind of character from Dickens' A Christmas Carol. That kind of image found its way into many movies of the time. And in the case of women, there was a stage play that was really popular during the 19th century called The Two Orphans, and it became the basis for at least 7 or 8 silent era movies about two young women, one of whom is blind, and they spend so much time trying to find a cure for her. And maybe the most famous movie adaptation of that story was made in 1921 by D.W. Griffith, who is far better known for Birth of a Nation, but he also made a movie called Orphans of the Storm, which was based on The Two Orphans. And the message seemed to be, in these kind of movies, if you're a good character, you'll be rewarded with a miracle cure. It's an image that Charlie Chaplin worked with in perhaps his most famous movie ever, a movie called City Lights that he made in 1931. There's a young woman who is blind, and she's a flower seller. And the tramp character that Chaplin typically played in his movies, here in this movie, spends most of his time trying to raise money for a cure for her. So the message seemed to be, if you're a bad disabled person, you deserve to be removed. You'll be dead by the end of the story. But if you're a good disabled person, you'll be rewarded with this miraculous cure, and you'll be restored to the ranks of the able-bodied. A really unsettling set of messages that I think filmmakers were sending to people back then.
I want to talk specifically about a few different movies. One of the most disturbing ever made, you point out in your book, was Todd Browning's Freaks.
Yes.
I think it came out in early 1930s.
Yes.
And unlike a lot of movies, Freaks featured people with real life, real mental and physical disabilities. Can you tell me about that movie?
Sure. What's disturbing about this film is that, on the one hand, it tends to show the disabled performers in a favorable light. There's like a nice community of these people, and they interact well with each other as well as with their able-bodied peers. But by the end of the movie, they basically turn out to be a collective obsessive avenger. I mean, and again, you have to remember, this movie was directed by Todd Browning, who was a prominent figure among movie directors during the silent era. I mean, he was very big on the idea of developing this obsessive avenger character. And here we have an entire colony of obsessive avengers who seek revenge on a couple of able-bodied performers who had attempted to bilk one of their disabled cohorts out of an inheritance. And so it becomes this rather grisly revenge story at the end, and it really starts to follow that pattern of the obsessive avenger. And it really wasn't until the latter part of the 30s and into the 1940s where we began to see more positive image of disabled people. And I think a lot of that had to do with the returning veterans.
We're talking now, why? About, why would that lead to more positive portrayals of people with disabilities?
Because here are people who made, you know, major sacrifices on behalf of their countries and deserve to be held up in high regard. I mean, my guess would be that's the case. I mean, I've seen maybe one or two movies that showed a disabled veteran in a negative light, but the vast majority of them, whether it be from the World War II era or the Vietnam era, tended to show these veterans in a very favorable light for the most part.
In your book, you write, seems like one of the films you really like from that World War II era is The Best Years of Our Lives.
Yes. First of all, it's one of the rare movies to feature an actual disabled performer in the film. It was an actor named Harold Russell.
Wilma phoned.
Wilma? What does she want?
You.
Oh, why can't they leave a guy alone?
Because they're fond of you, that's why. What made you leave the house and get them all worried?
Oh, they got me nervous.
How?
Butch, it's nothing. I don't want to talk about it.
How'd they get you nervous?
Well, they keep staring at these hooks, or else they keep staring away from them.
You mean whatever they do is wrong?
Why don't they understand that all I want is to be treated like everybody else? Take Pop, for instance. He was cleaning his pipe like I've seen him do a million times. And all of a sudden he got conscious that he had hands, and I didn't, and he stopped cleaning his pipe, and he tried to hide his hands like he was guilty or something.
Give him time, kid. They'll catch on.
I guess the only thing that bothers me a bit about The Best Years of Our Lives is that his character is shown to be relatively helpless when it comes to getting ready for bed and just doing ordinary everyday things, where I think the filmmakers are trying to make the point that he really needs this other person. He needs a spouse to help him make it through life. In actual life, Harold Russell was very self-sufficient and could do lots and lots of things by himself. But the filmmakers, I mean, they felt that was the wrong message to send, I guess, at that time. And they felt it was really important to establish this other person in Harold's life who could work with him and help him achieve fulfillment or whatever.
When I think of movies portraying vets coming to terms with some kind of disability, the one that really comes to my mind is Coming Home. What did you think of that one?
It's one of those movies that has some extremely good sides to it and some not so good sides to it. For starters, it's one of the very first films that I can think of that deals with ordinary, everyday issues of access and transportation. For example, there's a scene where Luke Martin, who's the character played by John Voight, he's a wheelchair-using veteran of Vietnam. He's been invited over to the home of Sally Hyde, I think her name is, played by
Jane Fonda. Yeah.
And she's invited him over, but her apartment or her home doesn't have a ramp. And so the film actually shows him getting up out of his chair and having to kind of scoot backwards, sitting down up the steps, you know, and it's a very ordinary moment, but it's also a very extraordinary moment too, because that's hardly ever shown in the movies, just ordinary everyday problems of access that disabled people face, you know, constantly.
Well, it also broke a kind of barrier in terms of being real, in that it was one of the first, or maybe the first, to admit that people with disabilities actually have sex lives.
Yes.
Do you know that when I dream, I'm not in the chair. I don't even have a chair in my dream. I have legs. When I was a kid, I used to jump in my mother's kitchen and touch the ceiling. She used to get pissed off because I'd leave my handprints on the ceiling, you know.
Right.
I still check the snow reports, the conditions at Mammoth. I'm still the same person, you know. It's funny. People look at me, they see something else, but they don't see who I am, you know.
I think people have a real hard time seeing who other people really are. People don't see me like I really am. People look at me, I think, and they see, oh, cheery Sally, the captain's wife. Sometimes I feel like I'm becoming what people see.
You know, I spend 95% of my time at the hospital thinking about making love with you.
I've never been unfaithful to my husband.
This is one of the first films that I can think of that portrays a disabled person as a sexual being. I think one of the stereotypes of disabled people is that they are sexless, or the opposite extreme, that they're filled with these diseased lusts. You know, it's either one or the other. So this is one of the first to explore that topic. It really broke new ground.
One of the other really interesting issues, I think, that you raise in your book is the fact that over the years, so many physically disabled characters have been played by able-bodied actors.
Yes.
You know, as though there weren't any physically disabled actors around who were able to portray characters. Is that still the case?
Unfortunately, yes, it is still the case. And sad to say, I think for a number of Hollywood actors, it's kind of seen as a way of getting Oscar nominations. I mean, there have been a number of able-bodied actors over the years who have won Oscars playing disabled characters. I mean, John Voight did so with Coming Home. Al Pacino won an Oscar for playing a blinded Vietnam soldier in...
Scent of a Woman.
Scent of a Woman, back, I think, in 1992. Daniel Day-Lewis won an Oscar, I believe, in 1989 for his role in My Left Foot, where he was playing the Irish poet Christy Brown, who had cerebral palsy. And one of Day-Lewis's competitors that year was Tom Cruise, who was playing the wheelchair using Ron Kovic from Born on the 4th of July. So we have dueling wheelchairs that year or something.
So why do you think filmmakers have so much trouble getting past these very basic stereotypes that you've been laying out? I mean, it seems like over and over again, the same kind of stereotypes and the same sort of plots have been with us from the beginning of movies.
Yeah.
How come?
It's really difficult to say. I mean, I think part of it, and this is just a simplistic kind of an answer, but I think in some ways they're lazy. I mean, they sometimes filmmakers rely very heavily on literary documents from the past. And these are the kind of messages that novelists and playwrights have been pushing across for centuries. And sometimes filmmakers just kind of pick them up and don't really question them.
The filmmakers and the films really are simply reflecting larger cultural attitudes, and it's because as a culture in general, we have very limited ways in which we understand and perceive people with disabilities.
Oh, I think so. I mean, that whole notion of someone overcoming a disability, I mean, that is so deeply ingrained in our society, and you still see it all the time, like someone who's physically challenged, you know, that kind of language. You know, even journalists today, when they refer sometimes to people with disabilities, they talk about a person who's challenged and is trying to make this heroic comeback and so on. And it implies that if you don't try to return to the ranks of the able-bodied or whatever, that you're a failure, you know, and I think that's what a lot of disabled people find so disturbing about some of these images is that, like, here's an example. In the case of the movie on FDR's early adult life called Sunrise at Campobello, this is, you know, well before he became president, the movie concludes, and this is after he's contracted polio and has to use a wheelchair and so on, the movie concludes with him addressing, I believe it's the 1928 Democratic National Convention, and they show him getting up out of his wheelchair and taking 10 long, lonely steps to the podium to make his speech. And the movie concludes at that moment. We don't even hear him give the speech. It all focuses on his ability to get up out of the chair and walk those 10 steps. And the implication is, now he's returned, you know, however superficially, now he's returned to the ranks of the able-bodied. Now he's made his triumph.
Martin Norden is the author of The Cinema of Isolation, A History of Physical Disability in the Movies. He talked with Anne Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want a cassette copy of this hour, please call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Disability and the Arts, number 218B. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Mary Lou Finnegan, Debbie Builder, Anne Strangechamps, Doug Gordon, and Veronica Rickert, with engineering help from Marv Nunn.
PRI, Public Radio International.